Good evening, folks, and welcome to the Daily Evolver Live. It's Tuesday, October 1st, 2013. I'm Jeff Salzman with you from Boulder, Colorado, with Brett Walker on tech. And it's a beautiful, it's actually dark at 7 o'clock here, p.m. So we're moving into the fall season, and it feels like it. It feels kind of crisp and good. So I'd like to welcome my liberal callers with a happy Obamacare Day greeting, and to my conservative callers, happy Shut Down the Government Day. So a big day in the culture wars. But before I get to that big story, I just want to note something that just caught my eye, and just as another piece of the march of human progress. I don't know if you saw it, but the president of Barilla Pasta apologized today in this sort of hostage video that he posted, where he apologized for saying something a couple weeks ago, I guess, in a meeting with advertising executives, that he wouldn't run for his pasta company. This is a multinational pasta company out of Italy. Guido Barilla is his name. That he wouldn't use same-sex couples in his advertising because he thinks that he would prefer to use traditional families. And, of course, this caused a big uproar. Actually, not of course. This is what's kind of new, is that for a multinational company to have the kind of blowback that he had, where there's petitions and I think there's over 100,000 people signing on to a boycott and protest of Barilla Pasta. A couple of his competitors came out with ads showing pennies with pennies and bow ties with bow ties, and the headline being Pasta for All. So it's this whole big thing going on. And so he had to come on, and he said that he obviously has a lot to learn about the evolution of the family, and he said that, used that term twice, and I like that anytime I hear evolution. And that he would be meeting with the members of the gay and lesbian groups over the next couple weeks and learning some sensitivity. The petition called on Barilla to declare a full commitment to equality, including LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered, non-discrimination policies, full benefits for same-sex couples, and sensitivity training to ensure an inclusive work environment. So, yeah, the green political correct machine continues, and this is not a bad thing. I don't say that necessarily pejoratively. I think it can go too far. But to the degree that it is not okay to, if you're working in the modern world, in modern societies, it's not okay to have those kinds of preferences be public, I think that's to the good. And I did notice myself yesterday, when I went to the store to make, actually, the recipe that was in Marcella Hazan, if you are cooks, you know that our great Italian exemplar chef died yesterday, and she was on the cover of the New York Times, and they printed her classic tomato sauce recipe, and I made it yesterday. So Godspeed, Marcella Hazan, and Barilla, welcome to the future, Guido Barilla. So that's always interesting. There's just things always popping up that just show the, you know, march of progress. And another one, of course, and this is up for grabs a little more, is Obamacare. Debuted this morning, or the insurance exchanges debuted. And, of course, they were overloaded. And the Republicans spun it as that it's a mess. And if you like the DMV, you're going to love Obamacare. And Obama and the lefties spun it as everything is so popular that it was just overloaded. So we'll see how that goes. But the other news, we focused a good bit on Obamacare last week, and I want to focus really on the government shutdown and the real struggle between these two worldviews that are online in American culture. And that's really what Integral invites us and allows us to do. It's, as Ken said, let's step back and get a 30,000 foot view of what's going on. And we see that this is today, with the government shutdown is a particularly dramatic day of brinksmanship, political brinksmanship, that is interesting and fascinating and not inconsequential for, you know, for instance, 800,000 people who are not working, who were. But it is, again, as these things tend to be, largely symbolic, at least at this point. We'll see how it goes in 3 weeks when there's an actual battle over the, raising the debt ceiling. I actually think what's going to happen, and who knows, of course, but if I had to guess, I'd say that Obama will, in the next day or two, he'll let the pain sink in a little bit more and let the Republicans see what a box they put themselves in. Because even in real time today, the government shutdown is a means of stopping Obamacare, which is not favored by the majority of the American public. Most people think it's some version of a mess. That a government shutdown is not the way to fight it. And so I see in real time today, the numbers went from 50% don't shut down the government to over 70% later today. But, you know, depends on what polls you're looking at, but I think these are generally right. But what we're seeing is, from an integral perspective, a first-tier struggle, a first-tier food fight, and this is kind of what makes the world go round. I mean, it's something that I emphasize regularly, is that this should be happening. Apparently, God set it up so that we conflict our way forward. And this is true in the tooth and claw nature of nature. And it's also true in politics. And that there are two sides, and this is just the nature of first-tier structures, first-tier psyche, that think that they're right. Which means, of course, that the other side is wrong. And it's not a big stretch to go from the other side is wrong, to the other side is bad, to the other side is evil, to the other side must be stopped at all costs. And this is the position that at least the, I would say probably 20, the Tea Party, the far right, has taken in this last stand against Obamacare with the government shutdown. And of course, the left sees them, and this is a lot of the mainstream media as well, sees these Tea Party, particularly these Republican House of Representatives, representatives in the House, that they're acting as anarchists, hostage takers, zealots. I think there's some truth to that. And they see themselves, of course, as principled legislators who are following the will of the American people who don't like Obamacare. And especially, and this is really important, they're following the will of their constituents. So there is a strong impulse, and it's particularly strong in America, and we'll get to that in a minute as I bring on my guest. But there is the sort of antibodies to government and regulation and the sort of pernicious force of government power. Of course, human beings are very smart to distrust the concentrations of power wherever we find it. History has shown us that their concentrations of power are dangerous. But it's interesting to see it in these culture wars that people on the right fear government and people on the left fear corporate power. And I'm not sure it's not in equal measure, not necessarily in terms of the distribution of population, but in terms of the distribution of intensity. I think of Occupy Wall Street, maybe not quite as intense. It certainly didn't have the government traction. I think of defunding the Iraq War, which is something that many of my liberal friends would have gone to the mat for, would have happily shut down the government in order to make this larger principled statement that we ought not be at war in the Middle East, and to demonstrate that fact to the president, George Bush, and to hopefully, if possible, rub his face in it and make him look bad. And there's even the sort of, when we think of the zealotry, I'm just trying to, as an integralist, feel into the mindset of the people who are really excited and giddy about shutting down the government, where they really think that this is the way to move forward, and they believe it. They're not trying to bring on anarchy. They're trying to bring on a better world for their children and grandchildren, just like everybody else. It's just that they see that differently. And so to feel into that antipathy towards government power, it's just a good exercise. And even to feel into it ourselves, I think of my own, you know, I'm basically a good liberal, although I grew up in conservative bastions of Western Pennsylvania, the God and Guns people. So I have a pretty good understanding of where they're coming from and sympathize with the moral hazards of, for instance, a big safety net of unemployment and Social Security and disability, where people can work the system and people see their neighbors who are living off of the system and seem as healthy as they are, and the corruption and the inequality of that. And it makes them mad. And, of course, you know, to use the example of the DMV is always a handy example for people who are against big government. Although I will say that in Boulder, the DMV actually operates pretty well. It's a little bit like going to the Apple store. You see your number and you sit there and there's a bunch of people and they treat you good. And it actually is a pretty well-run organization, as opposed to the Boulder Planning Department, which approves new buildings in Boulder, and I've had some dealings with them too, where it literally now takes 5 months to get a building permit in Boulder. 10 years ago, when I remodeled my house, it took 5 weeks. And this is the sort of pernicious creep of regulation that could come online that a lot of people have a lot of antibodies to, and liberals don't so much. Although that can change. I know there's people who deal with the planning department, for instance, and I was with a friend not long ago where we brought in an inch-thick proposal for a building and had forgotten some pages or whatever and had to make copies. And rather than copy them for us, because there was a copy machine right there, we had to go and copy them and bring them back. It's just a little humiliation that really is indicative of government at its worst. And I have a friend in Boulder here. She's a good liberal pedigree, grew up with good liberal parents in New York and Ivy League. And she's so frustrated by the endless demands of the Park Service in terms of containing and licensing and training our dogs that it's, as she put it, it's enough to make me a goddamn Republican. So we'll see how that goes. But I do. I think that it's really important as integralists. I mean, we could have our sides in this, and I'm in favor of Obamacare. I think it's literally, I guess you could say just by definition, it's the best we could do if you're for an increased safety net, which I am, by and large. I mean, I could see it happening in a number of different ways. But, you know, after 40, 50 years of trying, apparently it's the best we could do. And as with a lot of these programs, and last week I mentioned Social Security came online in 1935. In 1935, Social Security, let me see, I have the numbers here. The 1940 benefits totaled $35 million. In 2009, so this is what, 4 years ago, $650 billion, one out of four people receiving Social Security benefits. That's big growth. And it went from a program when introduced in between 1935 and 1940, it was very touch and go with Social Security. And as I talked about last week, it started out basically including a certain category of working white men and was scaled back, and we had the Supreme Court packing and all of that stuff that went attended to Social Security. And then over time it grew, it got better, it got fixed, and now we have a program with an 80% approval rating that virtually no politician will touch. Of course, this is the fear of conservatives with Obamacare, is that it actually will be popular and will just become part of the system. So on this call, I want to always pay attention to what the other side is thinking, and not from the perspective of finding out how they're wrong or demonized, but actually what piece of the truth they have. And I also want to challenge the idea that in order to be integral, you have to be sort of the traditional green liberal political stripes. I don't think that's true. I think there are some of the most interesting people in the integral world are actually arguing for conservative principles. And I have one of those people on my call tonight, and I want to welcome Marty Keller to the call. And let me, before I get to you, Marty, let me just say a couple things about you. And that is, I got to know Marty over the comments section of my these Daily Evolver calls as they're posted on Integral Life. And he's had some critiques, and sometimes actually quite scathing. I've learned from them. I think he's wrong in some cases. But it's been the beginning of actually a really wonderful conversation. And I was drawn to Marty's critiques even because I recognized a real intelligence, somebody who really knew what they were talking about, and who, again, came from something other than this reflexive liberalism that passes for political discourse in so much of the integral world. So I was interested. And so Marty has been part of the, he's in Sacramento, California, been part of the California state government under Governor Schwarzenegger, also reappointed by Governor Jerry Brown as the director of the Office of Small Business Advocacy. And he also has a master's degree in consciousness studies from JFK. So that's an interesting combination right there. And then the coup de grace is that he was a log cabin Republican, and which is, of course, the gay Republicans. And I believe in the 80s in San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken, Marty. Did you say that? Is that right? Welcome, Marty.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
So how's everything in Sacramento tonight?
Well, you know, the whole world has collapsed because the federal government closed down, so there's rubble and smoke everywhere I'm looking.
Well, it's actually an interesting experiment because nobody really knows what's going to happen with the government shutdown, and even with the debt limit. And we get so galvanized. I think we human beings are always looking to the leaders and where the power is. It's sort of in our genes to do that. And sometimes we overvalue. I think this is an experiment. And just how much does life go on? How much is, the sequester turned out to be a big nothing in terms of the bigger picture. Of course, it hurt some people or whatever. But this is a good experiment. And just how important is this? Don't you think?
Well, you know, it's of course it is, and we you and I grew up in the 60s, and we thought that was exciting times, and I actually think this is trumping that period.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I think it's trumping that period is because of something you said at the top of the hour, is that, you know, we're at a time where there is an enormous shift taking place. You know, the way I look at it is not necessarily the only way, but clearly. The information age is supplanting the industrial age, and the sensibility of the new era is so different from the one that we're leaving that there's inevitable clashes. My sense is that every time a new wave of consciousness has evolved, there's been enormous reaction from the one that's about to be supplanted or transcended. And, Amber's been at war with Orange for having the audacity to create individual dignity for 500 years or more. And we're still fighting our own amber internally and externally. And now green comes along and says, you're all wrong. It's just inevitable that we're going to go through some incredibly contentious times. And that's why I think the integral awareness is so useful, because it's the one place where we stand above all of it and go, well, okay, yeah, there's some truth in all of this.
Yeah. So with that said, Marty, what piece of the truth do you think the Tea Party has? Overall,
that,
and also in this particular battle, but
well,
overall
that,
as well.
Yeah, I, first of all, I'm not a Tea Party person, and I just like with Occupy, I'm not really sure if there's a unified Tea Party message. So just with that caveat in mind, I think that the Tea Party is a reaction to what they perceive as just an endless creeping collectivization of society being run by increasingly monolithic and intrusive government. You know, the country was founded, the founding principles are on individual liberty. And the space of individual freedom has been constricted rather dramatically in our lifetime. So just what the NSA could be doing right now to us is just would horrify the founding fathers that people would actually vote to create programs with that kind of snooping and intrusion. But it's happened so slowly over time that at some point people wake up and go, where is this too much? And my sense is that that's essentially the Tea Party message is this is too much and we got to stop it somewhere. Let's stop it here.
Well, yeah, when you think about American history, you could argue that, gosh, in the first 100 years maybe, you could almost say there was no government. There was the
pretty much
some taxation
at the federal level. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a big wide world there if you didn't count the Indians, and people had a lot of space, and there was a different kind of ethos that came here. You talk a good bit about some of the animating ethos that actually makes America special. The American exceptionalism is the Scottish Enlightenment. Could you tell us a little bit about how you see that and how that sort of informs a more conservative point of view?
Sure. So I think that if we're willing to take a broad view of this, if we're willing to look at the outworkings of history as the right-hand quadrant of an internal dynamic of evolution itself, we've gone from amber to orange. What a huge difference that was. For almost all of human history from the end of the Ice Ages until roughly the Renaissance, tribal consciousness was the dominant mode. And tribal consciousness was preliterate. It was oral consciousness. The way society needed to organize itself was basically agrarian or agricultural. And then suddenly there's this new thing shows up that essentially we call individualism or humanism or individual dignity. That began as a mass wave of consciousness with the Renaissance, although I've just been reading a fascinating book called America 3.0 that suggests that at least as far as the British roots of this, it goes back even before the Renaissance. And, you know, the within 100 years of the printing press being reinvented by Gutenberg and the Luther translating the Bible into German, the Protestant Reformation breaks out. You have political wars, now amber and orange fighting for essentially some place to, orange is trying to find a place to grow from and amber's trying to snuff it out. And all of a sudden, America is discovered by the Europeans, a place that doesn't have any of this inner mimetic war going on. And pretty soon, within a couple centuries, we actually have a nation that's been founded for the first time ever in human history explicitly on the principles of individual liberty, that you and I have inherently a God-given right, a pre-given right, a right of our birth to choose and create our own lives, uninterfered with by any tyrannical external force except those that we mutually agree upon. It's such an unprecedented thing in all of human history that we Americans in 2013 have a difficult time appreciating how radical that was. In fact, given Ken's observation, 70% of us on this globe still live in amber. It's still a radical shift.
Yeah, that's right. The idea of that sovereignty actually lies in me, not in you, the king, not in you, the warlord, not in you, the chieftain.
Or the priest,
but in me,
or the pope.
Or the priest. No, that's a radical achievement of human history. And you're right. The American Revolution was the first to really implement that. And it is indeed special. Now, all modern countries have come to that in their own way. And, you know, we see a social welfare system in Western Europe, like Denmark and Scandinavia and countries like that, where, you know, a lot of people travel over to those countries, and we hear the Western socialistic model and how decrepit it is and so forth. But people who travel there, it's like, well, this isn't so bad. And, you know, of course, from Japan to South America, every country at this point, at least every country who has a reasonable center of gravity at modernity or orange, has you know, enshrined human rights in one way or the other. It's just part of Orange, or at least part of the center of gravity of the elites of Orange.
Sure.
So to get that to we talk about these social welfare programs. What's the conservative alternative to that? I know you don't like Obamacare, and people who do like Obamacare are constantly saying, okay, you Republicans are just you're obstructionists. What are your ideas? Is it okay to have 30 million people uninsured? What's the alternative? And so I'd ask you that. And before you answer, Marty, let me just say one thing, and that is that if anybody wants to join this conversation, press 1 at any time. You can have a question or comment, and we'll get to those in a little bit. And also I wanted to say that if you're hearing us talk about Amber and Orange and so forth, you can go to the, and you're not following it, you can go to the dailyevolver.com blog, and under theory, you'll see, maybe scroll down a bit, and you'll see the altitudes of development, which explain what we're talking about. But basically, just in shorthand, Amber are traditionalists, social conservatives, more the right wing. Orange is modernity. That's secular. These are the rights of man. This is what was the leading edge of the American Revolution. And then what we call green or postmodern is the meme that arose, you know, maybe 100 years ago it started, but really came into force during the Cultural Revolution of the 60s. So these three structures are still very much online. They're all first tier in the sense that they all think they're right and the others are wrong. And our self-proclaimed role as integralists is to realize, first of all, the natural unfolding of these structures of consciousness evolutionarily, and also to see that each of them sees things that the others are missing, and that from an integral perspective, we really want to begin the project of integrating the best of all of these into something that's new. And that's what I'm really interested in, Marty, is, you know, what's the conservative, what's the piece of the truth that we liberals are missing about what's next, how Obamacare ought to be different, where it should go, what it should have been instead? So I just throw that out to you.
Well, yeah, I'm not willing to throw food around in the first tier food fight, but my bias in responding to your question is, you know, what's best for evolution? What's most important for a kid growing up today in Detroit, my hometown, a failed city, but every human being that's in that city still has equal dignity with you and me and all the rest of us. You know, what is the way we should be organizing ourselves so that we actually continue to perfect the project the founders started? Remember, they said in the preamble that we want to create a more perfect union. So they understood that there was no such thing as perfection as a destination. It was a process. So what question to me is, what is the perfection, especially given the fact that now we're entering into this information age world where technology may change every single thing that's controversial right now, from climate change to healthcare and so forth, in the course of the next 10 to 20 years. To me, the question is, what is going to make sure that every single person growing up in this country and in the long term, if we're going to support the shift from Amber to Orange globally, has the opportunity to become a self-fulfilling, self-actualizing individual human being. And I think that the conservative concern, and by the way, I'm not saying all conservatives have this incredibly sophisticated point of view that I'm raising. So for the conservatives, it tends to be more of a gut-level thing. The conservative concern is that the more you take away from me the capability and responsibility of deciding things for myself, the less an autonomous, sovereign individual, like you said earlier, I truly am, and that we could be creating a situation where we're moving from a republic of sovereign citizens to a place where we're wards of the state rather than citizens. So that's the conservative lens that takes a look at all big government programs. And of course, we're children of the 60s. The Great Society made all kinds of promises, the war on poverty and spent billions of dollars, and we still have poverty rates that are just as awful as they were in the 1960s. So a conservative asks, well, what good did all that money do? So I think that just as a tendency, conservatism being a type in Ken's model, which tends to ask, what is the best of what we've had, and how do we make sure that as we go forward we conserve that best, is looks at this time of great chaos and wonders how the heck we're going to do that when there are admitted pressures for security around issues like safety net and so forth that are perfectly legitimate. It's a perfect concern for somebody to say, I want to make sure that I maintain my capacity for a decent standard of living in a time where unemployment has gone crazy and this recovery relatively jobless, partly driven by information age technology, robotics, and so forth. It makes perfect sense to me that people as a mass prefer security as the first place that they're coming from. That's almost like Maslow's hierarchy of need. That makes sense. So that's part of why you see the 50-50 split that we have right now, because there are a lot more people are concerned about security than are about freedom at this point. That makes perfect sense to me.
Well, ideally, we do some integration where we have a lot of both. And I'm not sure we're not working our way towards that, Marty. I mean,
I'm hopeful that we are.
Yeah. I mean, when I look at, I mentioned Social Security. Social Security came online because after the Depression, to put it sort of vividly, people didn't want to see old ladies selling apples on the street corners. And that actually was happening. And that there apparently needs to be some sort of, the collective is part of reality. And there's never been a human system where you can opt in and out of the collective, except maybe some of the frontier of America as it was fulfilling its manifest destiny. There was some of that there.
Well, and that never left.
We hit the Pacific.
Right. And people piled in after those pioneers. So.
Yeah. But if we didn't have Social Security, families don't take care of people. Wanted to leave home. They went after World War II. How could you keep them down in the farm after they've seen Perry? They come back. They don't want to stay in the farm and take care of mom and dad. They'd rather create, which is what happened. It's sort of the intelligence of the collective that created a system that actually took care of things. And not only that, but I think one of the things we miss sometimes is that bureaucracy actually is an orange, lower right emergent. It's the system of orange, because before that was patronage. So if you were on the right side of the king, that was good, or if you were in the right side of the warlord or whatever it might be, you got the goodies. But modernity sought to even that out. And so we created this stultifying, we look at it now as being stultifying. Actually, it was refreshingly impersonal. That was the intention. Now, bureaucracies have a life of their own, and I think one of the really important insights of conservatism is that it's like you said, we were talking the other day, Marty, and you were saying, you worked as a regulator in California.
Yeah, I call myself a recovering regulator.
And you told me the story of how you sat one day looking out the window with a pencil in your mouth, thinking, now what can I regulate?
Yeah. And I called my friend and said, come shoot me.
But that is, I mean, there has to be some check on that. And if we look, and this is where I really sympathize with the Tea Party, is that, Republican administration, Democratic administration, administration after administration, including Reagan, including Nixon, including all of them, the government grows and grows, not only in real terms, but in terms of the percentage of the economy. I think that's right on schedule, but I get that it drives the Tea Party crazy.
Well, I think first of all, let's have a whole symposium on why it's not right on schedule, but And the reason why it's not right on schedule is because what gets missed in this conversation quite regularly is that we can't afford this. We cannot afford all of this government. You know, the United States government borrows $1 for every $2 it takes in from tax revenue. They're going to have a big fight in 2 weeks over the debt ceiling, and no one is going to drop his or her jaw at the fact that it's $17 trillion. $17 trillion of debt. So what that means is, for the next 20 years, we want to have all of these wonderful programs, Social Security, Medicaid. Gosh, I'm going to be 65 in 3 years. I want my Medicaid. And we're going to have to handle $17 trillion in growing amount of debt. The minute the Fed ends quantitative easing, the interest rates go up, and the ability to service that debt is going to cripple. It's going to cripple what's going on. So, you know, we got to take an integral view, has to take all of these things into account, and we just can't say, you know, we love the goodies, because the goodies are not cost-free.
Right. So what, and I don't say this as a challenge, I'm interested, curious, where would you cut it? What would you actually do?
Well, first of all, I think that's the wrong question. I still think the right question is, what kind of society do we want to have so that children can become self-actualized adults? If that isn't the conversation that integralists have, then, you know, we're just going to just argue. I think we have to be bold and imaginative. I don't know anybody who is proud of the government school system, for example. We have this shibboleth about how important education is, but if you could afford to, you wouldn't send kids to most public schools. I mean, that says a whole lot right there. The fact that we have so much government is, in essence, it's a confession of failure of our society, that we don't know how to take care of ourselves, and we don't choose to take care of ourselves individually anymore. Well, I don't know that we get into second tier except voluntarily. I don't think we get into second tier by coercion. So if we're going to have this great cooperative society where we, as Healthy Green would say, we all perfectly 100% accept the co-autonomy of every one of us, and there's nobody better or worse, then somehow we've got to find a way to move that into something people choose to do rather than are forced to do. And that's a dilemma because, again, we got 70% of us behind our back who are amber and saying, you know, we want to stop this whole orange thing and forget the green thing on top of all of that. So I think we have to start with the priorities. And I think the chaos that you started the show with, pointing that out, is a good thing because I think it's going to force us to pull our camera back and look at what's essential. If you have a $17 trillion debt, let's be honest, that's never going to get paid off. That's just not going to get paid off, not with our economy is at 1% to 2% growth a year. So what's essential? Now, where I come from as, quote, a conservative, end quote, is what's essential is liberating the wealth creators. If you want to have a lot of government, then you better have a lot more surplus than you have taxes. And well, let's have the conversation about how do we allow the great entrepreneurs and those young kids, 20-year-old kids right now who are thinking up crazy ideas, how do we make sure that they become successful business people so that they create the wealth of the future that's going to pay for all this stuff? Those are the kinds of essential questions I think that we have to ask. And as long as we're looking backward or as long as we're depending on these huge institutions, which Walter Russell Mead calls the blue social model, the institutions that served us through the 20th century when we were an industrial nation and we needed concentrated, centralized capital in both the private and public sector in order to maximize production and efficiency, the information age is now decentralized. So we're having these battles to preserve these old ways of being. I'm going to accuse Barack Obama and all the people that push these things as being conservative because they're trying to hold on to an old way of doing things instead of leading us into a brand new way, which technology is suggesting. The whole thing of healthcare, in 10 yeah. years, we're all going to have boutique healthcare based on DNA profiling, and we're not going to do things in healthcare the way we do now. It's going to change. Why don't we focus on those things is really the question I would ask.
And would you see that in that 10 years that the 30 million people who are without insurance and dependent on emergency rooms and so forth, that they would be knitted into the system, and how so?
Well, again, let's solve the problem by growing the pie. If we're not having that conversation, then we're just talking about rearranging deck chairs and, who gets the health care, who doesn't. I'm not interested in that conversation. I'm interested in having an economy so wealthy that this isn't really a problem. But we don't talk about that.
Right.
We talk about these other things, and it's kind of like, it's just kind of like focusing on the wrong thing and getting all excited about it. Well, okay. In the meantime, here's the economy, here's the American economy that single-handedly won World War II and single-handedly created the industrial behemoth that allows all of us to have this accumulated wealth to have these conversations.
Well, very good, Marty. I see that we have a hand raised, so let's go to a question. Mary Linda?
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? We have Marty on the phone, and Mary Linda, go for it.
My question is more to a kind of a curiosity. I agree with Marty. You certainly can't solve a problem back where it began. We've got to have evolution help us solve that. But I'm wondering if this Obamacare is really the problem here with what's going on with this shutdown and this big polarization. How much of it is really, do you think, about Obama himself? And I hate to use the word hate, that seems so strong, but I certainly think that there's a lot of fear around Obama. What do you think about that?
Well, I would just start by asking you and people listening to this call how you feel about Ted Cruz right now. And I think there's a lot of people who feel that same, or Jesse Helms, or Dick Cheney, or the George Bush Jr. at his worst by liberal standards. That's, first tier, it shows up as real deep antipathy. And there are people on the right. Pardon me, Marty?
Antipathy to the other, whoever we define them.
Yes, exactly. And so it is interesting because, I just love Obama. I mean, he's my guy. I do I call it Obama-pologia all the time. But I get that there are people who have the same visceral reaction to him as I have towards Ted Cruz, although I'm actually working on, I have quite a grudging admiration for Ted Cruz. But it's still that emotional thing just arises under its own power. Does that make sense to you, Mary Linda, or how do you see that?
Well, yeah, I think they're all players. I mean, they're all players of evolution. They're playing their part and playing it pretty well.
Can I offer something?
Yeah, you bet, Marty.
First of all, thanks. It's a great question, and here's another way to look at it. So what if we looked at what's happening in the United States politically as a single unit, as a one? What do we see? We see that there are that the one has disagreements in itself. And I'll tell you, as a human being, I have disagreements with myself. I have voices in my head that condemn me all the time. And, so I have a personal experience of amber, orange, and green raging in my head on a regular basis. So what we're looking at is different parts of us have different perspectives about what's going on. And Jeff said, that's first tier, so it means each part thinks it's right and everybody else is wrong. So I think that the value of the integral perspective is to, what I work on personally is how do I embrace all of it? Personally, I wouldn't vote for Barack Obama if you paid me $1 million. So Jeff and I don't necessarily see eye to eye on that. On the other hand, as you said, he absolutely is playing a role. As Jeff said, I can admire him for the things that he's achieved. It's quite a remarkable story on a personal level. But these guys are just, the politicians are us. They're us. The civil war that we see in Washington is our civil war. It's not Obama and Cruz and Harry Reid and John Boehner. These are us. Those are our fellow citizens that we have chosen collectively to represent us. And by the way, I think they're doing a great job reflecting who we are as Americans.
I do too, Marty. I think that's so well said, and it's such a pastime of everybody. I mean, you just see it on the news relentlessly in conversations with your family, your friends. Look at these people, these fools.
Right.
These people can't do anything. It's a giant projection of our shadow.
Yeah. Exactly.
These people who are actually operating, for the most part, they're human beings. You know, we have to give human beings a break. But they're actually operating, you know, relatively rationally and reasonably, considering their worldviews and the people who sent them there.
Exactly. I mean, that's part of the beauty of the integral model, is that these frameworks, these perspectives, have dependable structures. I think Green has a less dependable structure because it's very new, and that's why it's a little bit more over the map, I think, Orange and certainly Amber are, but nonetheless, it's reliable. Once you figure out where someone's coming from, you can almost write the script of what they're going to say next in a political conversation.
Yeah, and everybody gets to like roll their eyes and say, "Oh, these, you know, look at these corrupted,
right,
whatever." You know, it's.
Well, for me, here's the
funny
great thing.
I do it myself.
Exactly. So for me, the great thing about integral is that when I roll my eyes, it's an invitation to myself to look and say, "Okay, what's my perspective here?"
Yeah.
To develop a witnessing perspective that can witness my own eye rolling and go, "Oh, okay, I got that. I see where that's coming from."
Yeah. Well, the witness perspective is one of the new structures that come on. Yeah, Mary Linda, go on. And then we have another question here, so I want to...
Yeah, I'll just finish up my part. I agree. I mean, I think we can see, you know, that each person has grown up in a conditioning environment. You know, if you grew up in a conditioning environment where you were very Republican or very Democrat, or you were, you know, of more of elite, or maybe you were more middle class, there's a lot of worldview conditioning going on. It's all about conditioning, whether you're conditioned at amber, orange, you know, you've moved into green, and, you know, small percent probably tipping integral. But it's still all about conditioning. And then when you peek at integral, I think you begin to see all the conditioning. You can see it in yourself. You know,
can see. Well, that's what's so interesting. And you, you know, I'd add one thing to what you said, Mary Linda, and that is it's conditioning plus evolution, or conditioning plus emergence, in that, yes, I was raised by the conservative, God-fearing people of Western Pennsylvania, and my center of gravity went to that relatively quickly, and I kept going. I started reading Ayn Rand in mid-teens and lost my religion. I entered Orange. At the end of college, I moved to Boulder and entered Green. I found Ken in my late 20s and entered Integral. As Ken says, nobody knows why the emergent updraft catches some people and not others, and in different ways. And so it just becomes, you know, interesting. So I see we have another question from John.
Hi, thank you. Okay, when I think about innovation and changing the question, I really appreciated what you said about what should the question be that we're asking, and the question could be, how can we take America into the next 50 years and be competitive so that we can pay off this debt? That resonates with me. And my question is, I start to sort of try to answer that question, and I run into the same old conservative and liberal arguments. And I was wondering if you could kind of coach me to get beyond those arguments and empathize with the conservative and liberal perspectives from more of a second-tier perspective. So can I tell you what I think the conservative and liberal arguments are, and then maybe you can answer me?
Yeah, give it a shot, John.
Okay, so to invest in innovation, we have kind of a portfolio of places where we could spend money as an integrated society. We can spend money on transportation, energy, communications, info technology, and agriculture, etc. Conservatives would argue, let's take the brakes off innovation, let's lower taxes on corporations and businesses and investment, liberals would argue, hey, if we let the people with the money, the old conservative monopolists and oligopolists, spend money on drilling new oil wells, they'll be thwarting the new technology, which should be solar. So both sides have a piece to the truth. And how can I shift into an orange perspective, or a second-tier perspective, and kind of work with that and empathize with both sides and then go beyond that?
John, welcome to political leadership. Those are the kinds of questions that true leaders ask. And the analysis that you offer is, quite useful and quite valid. Again, I think where I would want to start with all these things is what I do when I advise small business clients who are in trouble. It's like, let's take stock of what our assets are. Because the whole point of a productive enterprise, as Jeff can tell you as a business owner himself in his past, it's to maximize your assets so that you're applying them appropriately so that you can maximize your profits or surplus, depending on how you want to measure those things. So there's always going to be self-interest, and the people building the solar panels have the exact same self-interest as the guys drilling for oil. So the question to me is, what is the ultimate asset of the United States? Well, the ultimate asset of the United States compared to all other economies still is our innovative capital. And so I personally say, from a second-tier perspective, let solar and oil duke it out while we focus our energy on developing our human capital, our intellectual capital. We do a dramatic overhaul of our education system up and down. From a second-tier perspective, what do I want to train people to do? Well, the emerging economy needs people who can think and innovate on their feet. We've left the industrial age behind, where the thing we needed was people who could work in a factory, punch a time clock, and run a drill punch. What we need now is people who can do a lot of different things quickly. So how do we train our kids to do that? That, to me, is the essential question, because our asset is intellectual. Our assets are the innovative spirit that has been the United States. Let's drill down on that. The market's going to do what it's going to do in terms of producing the things that the economy or that the people in the economy want. But what it can't do without direction and support is educate folks, prepare folks for the coming economy. That's just my first take at your really excellent question.
Yeah, I'd actually agree with a lot of that too. I like the duke it out part. I think sometimes we think, what should we do? What should we favor? Where should we put our money? Well, the fact is that millions of people are making those decisions every day based on their own self-interest, based on their own understanding of how the world works. And that's a very potent thing. And we want to keep that alive and vital. And I actually think that, there's some danger to that from an overregulated, overtaxed environment.
Jeff, you are a closet conservative, because you want to conserve that. That's among the best of who we are. So welcome
Absolutely.
To our ranks.
Well, I proudly accept that mantle, as long as you listen to this next part.
Go for it.
I think that what you said, Marty, about educating people and preparing them for this is absolutely a role of the collective. I think that can be also decentralized, and I think people can have a lot more choice in that kind of thing with education with their children. But I also think that the collective, it's as important as the autonomous individual, is an achievement of human evolution. So is an intelligent collective. And that there is some system that you can't opt out of that has everybody participating and taking care of the weak, sick, the people who can't take care of themselves, and we have to watch the moral hazard of that we don't make people complacent and, to choose, to be taken care of, which is a mighty appealing to choice for people, and a lot of people would choose it if they could, and a lot of people are choosing that ought not and getting away with it. But I do think that that's an appropriate role of government, and I think the debate goes on, but
if I'd like to be a liberal for 1 second, I don't disagree with that at all. I just think that that's something that should be done at the lowest possible level of government, which traditionally has. Education's traditionally been the responsibility of the local school districts and you know, what the federal government's doing, and I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, welcome to liberalism, man. Hey, maybe this is second tier, Marty.
What do you think?
Well, let's keep slugging. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate you coming online. You can find more. Marty has a great blog called Aqual Blog, A-Q-A-L, based on the Aqual Theory of Ken, all quadrants, levels, lines, and so forth, Aqual Blog. And I've enjoyed having you on, Marty. I've enjoyed our conversations. We're going to continue. I'll post some conversations with Marty, and we'll keep it going, my friend. Thank you.
Jeff, I appreciate it. Appreciate your leadership.
Thank you. All right. And thank you, everybody, signing off tonight, October 1st. We'll keep an eye on this government shutdown, see what happens, and check in next week and see how the world has turned. All right. Take care, folks. Bye-bye.